Welcome to the Oncology on the Go podcast, and our first in collaboration with the American Psychosocial Oncology Society, hosted by Daniel C. McFarland. In the inaugural collaboration interview, Daniel McFarland was joined by Michelle Fingeret to discuss body image issues associated with oncology treatment. The pair delved into how to identify those patients who may need additional support services, how clinicians can begin to ask specific and targeted questions, and how to put their expectations for the patient aside and allow the patient to guide where they would like to be.
Thank you to Michelle Fingeret for being here with us today. My goal is to bring some of your expertise to the patient-facing side of oncology. You know, over the years, it's kind of come to my attention that most oncologists want the very best for their patients, but on a psychosocial level, delivering that care is challenging for so many reasons. You know, we struggle with access to mental health care, and also limited training. I remember I had a month of palliative care training as an oncology fellow, along with a few lectures and seeing patients in clinic alongside my attendings. But that was actually the bulk of really what I received in terms of psychosocial care in oncology. And when thinking about this dilemma, I like to start where the patient is coming from and really what they're bringing to the table. And as a psychiatrist and oncologist, I can see both sides of this issue. Another very important reality, as you know, Michelle, is that meeting with an oncologist can be highly therapeutic on an emotional level. We have an understanding of our patient's illness beyond what they've come to expect in looking through Google or talking with friends. And oftentimes they feel lost, and we're kind of a beacon, you know, a beacon of knowledge and emotional support. There's just an enormous opportunity here. And so our therapeutic actions really do extend beyond the bounds of what comes in a pill or a chemotherapy bag. We aren't just deciding treatments, but we're creating a space or a scenario of healing, primarily through our close relationships with patients. Given this power and opportunity, alongside with positive outcome data on how supporting mental health improves so many cancer-related outcomes, it's astonishing that we don't have greater training in this area. And today's focus is going to be on body image. This could be something like a somatic preoccupation, dissatisfaction, or a functional issue, you know, something that no longer works right. We do so many things to our patients. We make them gain weight. We make them lose weight. We can sometimes leave them disfigured. We can leave them with swallowing or other functional impairments that they may have to live with. Short-term or long-term. That being said, Michelle, can you provide us with an overview of what body image is, why it's important, and how it influences our patients' mental health?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be talking about this today because I think this really is a core issue that you will encounter in the clinical setting working with any cancer patient. It's going to come up in one way or another. You know, body image is really at its core the personal relationship someone has with their own body. It's the way they think, feel, and perceive their bodies and all aspects of their bodies. So it goes beyond physical appearance. It also, you kind of mentioned this before, encompasses functional aspects of the body, sensory experiences of the body. So it's a pretty broad umbrella. And, you know, I've devoted my whole career to just working on this one primary issue in the mental health setting, is to really address the various ways that our adult cancer survivors will struggle with body image and how we can best support them in the oncology setting. So some of that is working as a psychologist, where I will do very focused work with my patients, but a lot of it is also supporting the nurses, the doctors, the physician's assistants as they're working with patients, and this comes up during clinical encounters because it's a pretty pervasive issue, right? I mean, any cancer survivor that goes through treatment is going to have something, they're going to have to adapt to some sort of body image change. It could be big, it could be small, it could be visible, it could be less visible, but it's kind of a universal experience that all of our patients will go through. And we really need to be equipped to identify and help patients through that process because it's pretty universal experience. Now, not everybody struggles to the same degree, but we have to kind of parse that out and figure out What is either being said by the patients directly and listening to that, or maybe what's not being said and how do we get at that? So hope that answers that, body image is important on many levels, but it really does affect everybody. Everybody comes into this experience with their own experience of their bodies, right? And then it changes as they go through treatment. So there's a lot to work with there.
There's a lot to work with. Absolutely. Do you feel that we're catching these issues well enough, or do you feel that we're missing it, that the conversation could be deeper, more extensive?
Well, I'll
What does the
say that,
literature suggest?
yeah. Well, I'll say from my work with clinicians and from healthcare professionals that they will identify a pretty huge gap in resources and saying, I know this is a problem and I don't really know how to address it. So, from that perspective, I don't know how, I think there's a lot of awareness that there's a lot of body image issues. So, from that perspective, you're not missing it. You know it's there, but you don't know what to do about it. And I do think there is a lot of evidence to suggest that we are missing patients who are struggling. So some of the work that I did, I work a lot in the reconstructive surgery space. And so if you think about it, the whole point of reconstructive surgery is to help replace form and function, to help restore form and function. It's all body image at its core. And my work has shown that about 95% of those patients are going to identify some degree of concerns, preoccupation with appearance or functional change on some level. And that about a third of those patients are actually open to therapy to help to counseling to help address some of those issues. And I can guarantee you that a third of those patients aren't getting referred. So, one out of three patients is not getting a mental health referral to address body image. So I do think we're missing it. And a lot of it is because a lot of patients feel ashamed and guilty to be struggling with body image, right? They don't feel comfortable talking to their healthcare providers because they're thankful and grateful to all of the things our healthcare professionals are doing for them. And they don't want to bring up this as an added burden. They feel vain. This is a common theme that you're going to find throughout working in this setting, says that patients are reluctant to bring it up. So we have to be prepared to proactively bring this into the room and to talk about it.
I think that's a great point. It reminds me of other sort of sensitive topics that we have to bring up, such as, let's say, fertility, a sexual function, things that we may or may not be all that comfortable talking about, or we might feel that it's just too personal. And I completely agree with you that I think I see that with my patients as well, that there's this sense of, boy, you've done so much for me. I don't want to ask another thing, and I should be grateful. There's a lot of oughts and shoulds and sort of moralizing that happens here. And we have an immense power to help patients in that regard, validate and normalize these concerns. And in a lot of ways, that's all that, frankly, what if we can do that? That's way more than half the battle in terms of getting patients kind of what they need. Through what you said, I'm getting a sense of kind of a spectrum, that there is varying degrees of this issue. And one of the things I often encounter in dealing with mental health in the cancer setting is that, let's say, us as oncologists, we might remember back to medical school when we did our psychiatric rotation, and we think of that depressed patient who was admitted. Similarly, there's a body dysmorphic syndrome, right, in the DSM, right? But one of the issues there, and that's a very serious disorder, and it's essentially kind of a delusion, not in touch with reality. But the issue is that there is not a actual body image or a body or somatic issue. There's no chemotherapy that's taken place or surgery. And so it seems like that's one of the things that's most challenging, because there can be a reality to there's a change, and like you said, it's that relationship, and depending on where someone's starting, that may be the central focus. The other part of it might be that there's other sort of comorbid psychosocial issues, maybe. And so I guess I kind of wonder. A couple of things. One, how do you sort of tease apart, is my patient depressed? Is my patient suffering from this body image issue? And which sort of thing should I address first?
So there's so much that you just brought up. I could take this in a lot of different directions. I'm not gonna. I'll get to the answer on that question about where you start. But a big part of why I spent so much of my earlier part of my career being prolific and writing about this is because I wanted to provide people with a framework of how do you think about this. What's the framework going in? And so you talked a little bit about body dysmorphic disorder. And so I'm going to touch on that for a minute because it's a lot of the symptoms that you may see there, with the exception, as you've mentioned, if this is not a imagined or exaggerated defect or flaw. All of this is real changes that are happening to people's bodies. Now, we all know that some of our patients, the ones who are more vulnerable to having significant levels of body image concerns, have a whole history of how they felt about their body, how invested they were in their appearance, and all of that. And they're coming into it with a complicated, way that they're presenting. The ones that are at the more severe end, you kind of talked about mild, moderate, severe. So there's a couple of things. We talk about making sure you have this theoretical framework that all of these symptoms around body dysmorphic disorder, things like preoccupied with changes to your appearance or preoccupied with the body, things like avoiding social activities, reassurance seeking, excessive grooming or avoiding grooming, all of those things are very relevant to assess. And you'll see through some of my writing that I will give, the clinicians, here's a way to approach a body image assessment. And it's assessing for a lot of those same symptoms. Now, I don't pathologize things in terms of dysmorphia, or really. In the end, having body image concerns is normal, common, and to be expected. So we want to take out this idea that any of this is a patient exaggerating or imagining something, even if the concerns they have are so severe and extreme. You may have that. A patient comes in and says, they're dissatisfied. They don't want to have any scars on their body whatsoever from their reconstruction. Well, and they're highly distressed about it. Well, okay, they're at the severe end of how they're adjusting to that. But the fact that they're concerned about the scars in the first place is actually very normal and very common. So we have to
Pie.
walk that line, right? And then we're talking about this idea of classifying people into kind of mild, moderate, and severe, maybe. I do have other things that I have written about and frameworks that I've developed that look at this body image continuum and where do people fall. And one thing I want to mention here is that I have on that continuum people that say, I don't have any concerns about body image. It's not something I'm worried about at all. And I talk a lot in some of the educational seminars that I do around this, where I'm trying to work with healthcare professionals to explain that some patients may legitimately not have concerns about body image. They may see their scars as a badge of honor. There's some way that they have this like post, traumatic growth experiences, these growth experiences from a positive adaptation. But within that category of people who deny body image concerns are those that are just reluctant to admit because of the shame that they really maybe have more normal or average amount of concerns. And so what I do in some of my work is I really try to help make it very clear what are the different levels and what are some of the symptoms associated with that. So, again, you asked me kind of where we start with that, whether because having distress about body image, yes, they're having body image concerns, and then they're having this, dysphoric reaction to it, whether it's severe depression or whether it's mild to moderate depression, we would need to evaluate that. But you're really going to have to treat those in tandem because they go together, especially if the distress is a result of or the source of their distress is concerns about body changes, whether that's things that have already happened to them and they're having struggles with that. But a lot of times it's the worries and the anxiety and the anticipatory anxiety about what body image changes are to come. That's a huge place where we have the opportunity to intervene with patients, is all of that anticipatory anxiety.
That's wonderful. What I'm hearing is that, there's actually several different issues here. One is, the patient's assessment of the change that has or will take place. And then on top of that is the distress or the feelings around that change. Like I could imagine, you might have a patient that there's a huge change, very little distress, or a small change, a lot of distress. And
Right.
alongside that, I could see this happening very readily where, we often will kind of normalize things for patients. And that can be helpful, but it can be detrimental in the sense that, what I'm taking away from what you're saying is it's really important to kind of take the patient's lead on their assessment of what this change actually is, because something that might seem reasonable to us, because maybe we've seen this, 500 other times, and say, okay, that scar is really not a big deal, right? But for the patient, it's a huge deal, and vice versa. I mean, you could have a situation where you see something that actually is very, you would think would be very concerning to the patient, but they may not actually
For
express
sure.
those feelings. So
Yeah. A big part of it is listening to the language that the patient is using. I want them to describe for me, to tell me how your body has changed. And then I want to listen to the words that they're using. Tell me what concerns you have about how your body is about to change. And just listen to that piece. Get them to describe the body part. And then also, what is the meaning and importance of that body part to the patient? That those two things are a really important place of where you start. And the other piece I would say is just to make sure that you really familiarize yourself. Like you are going to be more comfortable in this space as a clinician, no matter, what discipline you are, how you're working with these patients. If you get the framework of what we're talking about, if you understand what does mild body image distress look like, what does, moderate body image distress look like, what does severe distress look like, and then you can have some of these algorithms for then, okay, what do I do with that? How much of that can I provide the brief therapeutic interaction I need, and the patient doesn't need more than that, and where do I really need to get this patient some more help? So there's a lot of resources out there, stuff that I have put together, and I have a book that has some of that information that I would encourage you if you're feeling like you want more information in this area. There's a lot of information out there that you can get. And it's not just me. There are other people who do this work. I happen to be more active in the oncology space, but there's other people who do this work with visible differences or facial disfigurement. It could be from any cause, right? People who undergo other medical illnesses, who have trauma, those, from an accident or burn survivors or things like that. There's a lot of literature out there that is very relevant to this that we can all pull from.
Yeah, there's certainly a coupling of medical issues too that happens. You mentioned language, and could you maybe give us some examples of language you've heard that strikes a chord with you or
Sure. I
puts your
mean,
antennae up?
well, sure. I mean, there's always the, okay, we have to fix this. What can we do to fix this? Right? There's a lot of that. There's a lot of very inflammatory, difficult language that patients use to describe themselves as far as being ugly or deformed, or I have a lot of patients who talk about their breasts. They'll give names to their breasts, right? Frankenboob is one that I've actually heard many, many times. And patients were like, "Oh, I'm not the only one who refers to myself that way." I said, "Oh no, I've heard that." So there's a lot of that. It's very painful. It evokes a lot of difficult emotions. And so part of it is hearing how they would describe their own bodies. And so I think those would be the best examples I can think of. Is it hideous? Is it ugly? Is it disgusting? Is it, And so some of the work that I do, I just kind of like to throw some things out there for people to think about. Is I will ask patients to take a step back and I call them out on their language and I'll repeat it back to them. A big part of it is, would you ever describe your friend this way? Oh, no, I would never say that about a friend. Okay, well, then why are we saying this about yourself? And then there's also ways where we talk about getting them to shift their language to be less judgmental and more neutral and more objective. So we might get them to describe their body parts. I would say, now I want you to imagine that I don't have the gift of sight. I'm blind. I don't know what ugly or disgusting or horrible is. Tell me what your body actually looks like. Use some language that I can understand. And so shifting that language, these are some cognitive behavioral techniques that you would use to kind of shift people's language and understand that the ways that they're talking about themselves is actually contributing to the body image distress.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So that's something to be on the lookout for, is language, which really kind of shows that relationship, like you said at the very beginning. We all have a certain kind of relationship with our bodies, beliefs about what our bodies are, can do, etc. We can kind of peer into that. What are the most common types of body image issues that you see, you know?
I mean, weight gain.
Weight.
Okay, weight gain is a really big one. But you know, anything. So you think about physical appearance, hair loss. You know, anything that is visible to others. You know, I work with a lot of head and neck patients, so there might be scarring or disfigurement that's visible to others. Things like that. Speech and swallowing impairment, which we wouldn't necessarily always think about as a body image issue, but under that tent of it could be appearance, it could be sensory, it could be functional. There's a lot of work you can do to help patients more with, you know, our goal is to help them gain a greater body image acceptance. It's not actually to like or appreciate or love their bodies. That's not what I do for my work. I work with patients to try to come to terms with things about their bodies that they still enjoy and appreciate and like, and things that they don't like, and how do we hold those together?
Yeah, that's striking. You know, it just occurred to me that I'll often hear from folks who've undergone head and neck cancer treatments that they no longer want to eat in front of other people, you know, and you think about that as a social impediment and how important meals are and things like that. So then the question would be, how do we get this person to be able to enjoy a meal with other people?
But is it? I mean, I'm gonna challenge you on that, right? Is
Please.
it that our role is to try to get them to enjoy that again, or is it to really understand the impact that that's having on them? Setting some, you know, we want to be realistic in our goals.
Sure.
How is it getting in the way of your everyday life? Are you not, you know, able to go and enjoy being around other people? It might not be about enjoying the meal or the experience. We have to kind of shift how we think about that with our patients because, you know. It's a big question. I know one of the questions around like, how are these therapies successful or what can you hope to achieve? And a big part of what I do with my patients is sometimes having to redefine what is success,
Okay.
right? What is
Yeah,
success
no.
in this area? Is it, and maybe your goal is to try to go and gain more enjoyment in those social experiences than you are right now. But there's a ceiling to that. And somehow it's figuring out a way to help give hope. I mean, you know, it's very interesting to me. I have very different conversations around how to do this work if I'm speaking to a patient audience versus a professional audience, because what's critical when working with the patients is obviously to help them maintain some sense of hope that things will get better. You know, whatever they're struggling with, they can learn strategies or techniques to help them address some of those things. And so it's maintaining that hope, but I also work really hard to be as realistic as I can to set those goals in an attainable way and to define success in a way that is achievable.
It's interesting because I was just aware of my own agenda in trying to get this, you know, head and neck patient to be able to eat with other people, because to me that would be success. But to that patient, it may or may not be. That may not actually be the goal, right? And so
Complicated. It's
it's
not
complicated.
simple.
It sure is. Yeah. So what does, like, if someone were to refer a patient to you, could you walk us through, I think you've alluded to some of the treatment, but maybe just kind of how you approach the patient.
I mean, you know, obviously it's as we've kind of talked about, it's really listening and understanding what the struggles are and what the patient's goals are, and where are they in their treatment, right? I would say the majority of people that make their way to me are going to have more long-standing body image issues. They were having concerns, their body, their appearance has been very important to them their whole lives. And so they're coming in now, and we're really having to take a little bit of a step back and understand that history. That understanding of like what's changed, how has it impacted them, and how is it impacting their life now? And then the goal is to figure out what are some incremental things we can do to help them address these concerns and these issues? So, does it have more to do with the distress they're experiencing and we need some distress management techniques? Is it more about this cognitive preoccupation and maybe we need to use some, you know, cognitive therapies to help them with that? Is it more avoidance? Do we need more behavioral strategies? So there's a whole range of things that we can do. And what I'd say is interesting because I both worked in an academic medical center. I was at MD Anderson for 15 years, where I ran a body image research and therapy program. And now I work in the private sector and have a private practice and do consulting work with other healthcare professionals all around body image. And the work that I do in those two settings is completely different. So at MD Anderson, a lot of my work was brief, it was focused. I would maybe see a person for a few times. And then maybe I'd see them again 3 months or 6 months later, depending on when they were coming back for follow-ups. But the work was, like I said, very, very focused on body image specifically and how to help them in that moment with where they were in their treatment trajectory. Now, in the private sector, I am seeing patients for a much longer period of time. I have these long-term clients that I'm seeing maybe once every 2 weeks, and we're really able to get into it. And it's not just about the body image, it's about body image and how that then affects their relationships. So we talk a lot more about their relationships in life, whether it's with their spouse or their kids or their friends. So we're getting into more issues, and we're not, body image is usually a starting point, but we don't really stay that focused on the body image piece kind of in the private setting, in a private practice setting. So I've had some experience in both areas where I'll approach it differently.
It sounds like you've kind of expanded your horizons a little bit clinically. And, it's always striking to me the difference in different settings. You see different patients in different settings. It's a truism, but it's really very real. And that's what you're describing. I'm also wondering, one of the things that has actually, as I read your work, you really get into very nitty-gritty details about the patients' lives in terms of, you mentioned some of the behavioral kinds of techniques, and it might be a matter of what are you wearing? Are you going to wear X, Y, or Z, or go to this event? And am I getting that right? That it's important to maybe kind of understand patients on a level that isn't more, not a generic level, but a sort of these are the intimate details of their lives. Is that a
I think kind of going back to being in a clinical setting in an academic medical center where you're really focused on the problem at hand right now and what is something very concrete, very specific that we can do that is going to help you feel like you're making progress towards adjusting and adapting to these body image changes. So rather than looking at the big picture of all the comorbid issues that are happening, I really did try to drill down into, okay, well, an example would be a patient who comes in and basically tells me that they have decided that they are never going to look in the mirror again after their surgery. And that is what we will spend an entire session on, is just kind of understanding how that plays out and how we can create some goals around, well, if they really don't ever want to look in the mirror again, let's talk through how that would play out versus, maybe we really do some really focused mirror work. Or I can give another example of a patient who had a thumb amputated and did not want to look at all there. And all we focused on was just getting them to get more comfortable with this kind of gradual systematic exposure to the thumb and not all the rest of the other things that are happening from a psychosocial perspective. Because if you're working in a cancer hospital, you have limited time with these patients to make meaningful progress with them. And so, yes, I definitely would try to really hone in on something very specific we could work on that would help them feel more supported in having these concerns, because most people are going to discount it. Oh, you'll be okay. Your hair will grow back. You just need more time. Everything gets better with time. All these kind of cliches that our patients are hearing. And when someone's able to stop and say, no, this seems like this is a really big problem for you. Let's talk about it. Let's acknowledge it. Let's label it. Let's talk about all the emotions you're having around this. Let's focus on this and not just brush past it, because this is important and meaningful. Body image is important and meaningful. And so I don't think that a lot, they don't get that a lot from their team, because
I realize that.
the reality is the team has a lot of other things they have to focus on depending on what they're coming in for. But it makes a
What's
difference for these patients because they stop and they say, no, it's such a different way that they're able to talk about this. You're giving them like the space and the permission to have these conversations that they're not getting in other settings. They're not getting at home either. People are just telling them to be positive and have a positive outlook, and that's so important.
Yeah, you're literally opening the door for them. And I think the really important point there is that, in the exam room, when you're seeing a patient who's dealing with something like this, they may very well say something to the extent of, "Oh, it's okay. I won't look in the mirror. That's my answer," right? And it is a answer. It's a bad answer, but it's an answer. And it's a pitfall for us as clinicians because in our mind, we have 70 other things that we need to do, and the patient just gave us a good reason to not actually stop and go further into that issue because they said, essentially, it's okay, I'm dealing with it. And so it's really hard to actually sort of it kind of takes two minds. You're sort of there with the patient, hearing the words that they're saying, but also kind of normalizing and thinking, does that make sense? Does that really make sense? And you approach it in a kind of inquisitive way, right? Like you sort of say, I wonder if there's more here. And that can make all the difference. Just that stopping. It seems like a lot of our work is about holding the space and stopping for a moment, right? And that I always tell people that that pays dividends down the line because it essentially shows the patient that you've seen him or her as a person, even in that brief moment.
Just quickly, as you were talking about this idea of what the patient's saying. And so you're in the room and you're talking to the patient. They're saying, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. It's okay. I'll be okay. And obviously, if they make the comment, I just won't look in the mirror, that's the kind of like ding, ding, wait, hold on, let's talk about this. They're oftentimes not going to say that though. They're going to say, I'll be fine. I'm doing okay. Like I'll be fine. And that's when you ask the question, have you looked at yourself in the mirror, or have you seen this in the mirror yet? And that's when you kind of start drilling down. Well, no, I'm just not going to. Okay, well, let's talk more about that and how you're feeling. How does that make you feel? What are your thoughts on that? And that's when you can really like have that opening. Because I had a patient who told her reconstructive surgeon that she was having no issues whatsoever. And when I got in the room with her and started kind of drilling down, I found out she hadn't left the house for 4 months. But she told the surgeon she was doing fine. Anyway, so that's just kind of an example that I provide of as you really just and dive a little bit into it. And it doesn't need to be a whole long conversation. It's just to ask those few little questions. You might get more information.
That's very helpful. That's very helpful because you can see how this can go awry. And that's part of the benefit of a patient coming to see us is that we've seen these things before and we can help. And oftentimes they may have no idea that there is even such an issue as body image or dysmorphia, et cetera. And so a little bit of curiosity goes a long way. Is the therapy for this issue successful?
So I think I alluded to that a little bit before. How do you define success? Okay, that's the real question. So, do patients benefit from getting support around these issues? Yes. Can we help people who are engaging in a lot of avoidance and isolation, live their lives in a different way and go back to doing things they used to enjoy and have more fulfillment in their social relationships and be more productive and feel more comfortable at work and other environments? Yes. So can we ameliorate all their body image distress? No. Can we get them to have, I mean, we have to define what we mean by body image acceptance. And part of it is accepting some of the distress, accepting some of the preoccupation. But as long as we're working with patients who have realistic kind of expectations for their treatment outcomes and, excuse me, are able to make some movements in addressing the distress, the preoccupation, and the avoidance, then yes, we can achieve great success with patients. It also depends on where they're starting from, too.
That makes a lot of sense to me. That's wonderful place to probably conclude our conversation. I often find that one of the things that I see patients doing time and again is almost making a certain kind of deal with themselves, that okay, I have cancer, but if I can just go back to where I was before, everything will be fine. And we know that no one can go back to the way things were before. And so even that as a starting point of, you know, that's why they talk about that new normal kind of thing. And I know it's cliche, but it is the reality of it. And so I hear that's what you're saying is that, you know, looking at how they might define success and sort of going over what that means and maybe seeking alternatives, and what they might accept as success, could be a very different thing. And so,
It's all
any
about
final
becoming more
comments, Michelle?
flexible and adjusting your expectations. Sorry. I
Yeah,
was just saying it's
at
about
a
being more flexible and adjusting your expectations. That's a huge part of the work that we have to do.
yes. You know, and that's challenging for oncologists because we're sort of used to, providing a very concrete sort of treatment and trying to get at a goal that is we can name it, we can target it, you know, and that's the issue with psychosocial kind of awareness is that the end point may not be what you expect it to be. I think that's a great point that you're bringing into this. Thank you so much, Michelle. I really have enjoyed talking with you, and I think this is going to be quite helpful to my fellow oncologists out there. And thanks so much for listening.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on X @CancerNetwork without the O or on Facebook and LinkedIn @CancerNetwork.